All right. Thank you, Eli. I'm not sure you want to hear any more about me. I will try to be interesting. Can we bring the lights down, maybe? Especially on the screen, the more the lights can come down, the better. At least for the audience, I think that will help. So as Eli mentioned, I'm Chris Eagle with the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. I teach computer science there. And if you were in the session earlier, I basically teach programming languages, I teach network security, I teach computer forensics. They asked me to teach forensics because of my background with reverse engineering and analysis of malicious software. So that's what my talk today is concerned with, analyzing malicious software, particularly software that has been protected with some type of protection mechanism. We'll say obfuscated. I'm not sure whether that translates well. But if you use the word protected, obfuscated, hopefully you can understand what I am talking about. Specifically, I do a lot of work with a tool called IDA Pro, and I will mention more about that later. So we'll work through an introduction. We'll talk about the operation of a tool I have developed, which does simulated execution of the x86 instruction set within IDA Pro. We'll do some demonstrations of removing the protection from various malicious programs, some fairly well-known viruses and worms we'll take a look at, and then we'll wrap things up. If at any time I'm speaking too fast and the translation seems to be falling apart, if the translators could maybe knock on the window or wave at me or somehow signal if anybody in the audience wants to raise their hand at me and tell me to slow down, please don't be afraid. This slide is for larger rooms and maybe smaller audiences because I will be doing demonstrations. It's nice to be up close because the font in IDA Pro can't be made any larger than it is. So you'll want to be close so that you can see all of the demonstrations as best as possible. So some background. IDA Pro is it's the interactive disassembler professional made by a company called Data Rescue, headquartered in Belgium. It is perhaps the best reverse engineering tool out there. I should say a disassembly tool for disassembling binary software. There are many ways to do reverse engineering. That's not what we're here to talk about today. Specifically, we'll just talk about disassembly with IDA Pro. The tool, or IDA, runs on Windows. However, with the latest release, which is 4.7, they are starting to develop Linux versions. I believe it's a Linux console version. Anybody? Console only. But yeah, they've released a binary, I believe, with version 4.7, which is the latest release. Hopefully, one day it will be a fully graphical interface on Linux, so we can all, you know, migrate off the Windows platform. So what I'm going to talk about today is a tool that I maintain. It has an ugly name. They're IDA x86 EMU for emulator. It's just a simulator for x86 instructions. It plugs into IDA so that we can, while running IDA, we can actually execute the x86 instructions that we see in our disassemblies in IDA. The tool is written in C++ using the programming interface published by the IDA people and made available in their software development kit, which is issued with each new release of IDA. So the tool is written in C++. I currently have it packaged for a compilation with Microsoft Visual C++, although there's really no reason that it couldn't be compiled with GCC and SIGWIN with appropriate changes to make files and such. The tool, you can get it via the URL that you see there. It's open source, available at SourceForge. So if you have IDA and you have the software development kit, you can download this tool and you can do all of the demonstrations that we'll go through today. Why I developed this? Well, looking at assembly language is difficult enough. Attempting to understand what that assembly language is doing is even more difficult. And trying to run a program in your head, stepping through it maybe with a pencil and paper, is even more difficult. So the idea is to have a tool that will do it for us, that will act as our pencil and paper while we work through a disassembly in IDA Pro. And specifically, something that will assist us, or at least assist me, in looking at protected programs. Okay, a typical protected program, if an author writes a virus or a worm, they don't want security people to be able to analyze that worm easily. So they take the worm, they encrypt it, or in some cases simple compression, and to generate a new executable that doesn't look like the original executable. So it's more difficult to understand the functionality of the worm. In order to get back to the original executable, the new executable, the new program, first unpacks itself or unencrypts itself so that the original executable is recovered, and then it transfers control to what is now the original worm, which does something bad. So the emulator lets us simulate the execution and recover the original worm, all within IDA Pro, all without ever having to run the program. Okay, the nice thing is IDA, if we're doing this in IDA Pro, we're doing it in somewhat of a safe environment because the program isn't really running. It can't really do anything nasty. So some typical programs that do this protection, these are almost all available on the internet for free, you know, to malicious users or to reverse engineers. UPX is the universal packer for executables. It can protect Linux binaries. It can protect Windows binaries. Burneye is a tool that can protect Linux binaries. Shiva is a tool that will also protect Linux binaries. TLOC, ASPAC, these are all tools that TLOC and ASPAC do Windows. And there are many, many others. Far too many to list here. But these are the five that we'll actually do demonstrations of today, and hopefully the demonstrations will work. So I wanted to be able to look at the protected binaries because most viruses and worms, at least in the Windows world, are protected with some form of protection tool like UPX, very common, ASPAC, TLOC. These are perhaps the three most common that I see. And the challenge when you just disassemble this is to get past that protection, because in a disassembly, all you really get to see is the decompression function. The rest of this assembly is just data. Until the decompression function executes, that data does not get turned back into executable instructions. Okay, so the idea is use IDA to simulate the decompression function or to emulate it, and then by the time that's finished, we get to see the original program in IDA. Okay? So we'll talk about how this works. If you've never used IDA Pro before, you'll get to see a demonstration shortly. But you basically ask it to load the binary that you would like to analyze. IDA looks at every byte of the binary, every instruction, every piece of data in the binary, and puts it into a database. And attempts to determine, is the byte an instruction? Is the byte a piece of data? And if it's an instruction, it attempts to build instruction ordering information, instruction flow, data. It generates cross-references. It attempts to identify individual functions within the program. It builds data references from the functions to the data. And in the end, you have your binary now imported into a database. So as an IDA user, what you are really doing is manipulating a database. Okay? Again, you never run a program. You're just manipulating a database. You can add comments. You can reformat. But you're making database operations. And this is why working within IDA is safe. Because you may corrupt your database. You may reformat the code in the database incorrectly. Okay? But you are never doing anything hostile on your computer. One hopes. Now, what the emulator does is... Now, let me follow my slides, I guess. So, obfuscated code is difficult for IDA Pro because the program, after it has been compressed or encrypted, looks like data. Remember, IDA is trying to decide, is a byte data or is a byte code? And because all of that data, all of the compressed code now looks like data, IDA has a hard time. It miscategorizes all of those instructions that should be code and calls them instead data. There are other techniques that we'll see. Sometimes these tools create code sequence where one instruction jumps into the middle of another instruction. So we have instruction alignment problems. And IDA has a difficult time with that. And we'll see examples in the demonstrations, if that's not clear now. The plugin consists of two pieces. It has a user interface. I tried to separate the functionality because the user interface is very Windows-specific. Because IDA runs on Windows, it provides a graphical means of controlling the emulation. The second piece is an x86 emulator, okay, which is, just looks at an instruction, decodes it into its appropriate x86 instruction, and carries out the action dictated by that instruction. So we have the user interface interacting with the emulator, and what happens is, as the emulator runs, it manipulates the IDA database. So it helps, it changes, if, for instance, if we are running through a decompression or decryption portion of the program, and we emulate that, then the emulator will be changing all of the data bytes back into instruction bytes. And when we get through the end, then we can ask IDA to reorganize all of the portions that were formerly called data back into code. The emulator is also sort of platform independent. So you can take the emulator piece out entirely and use it to build standalone decompressors if you want. And I'll refer you to an old talk I gave about a tool called Shiva, in which I use this tool largely to do much of the reverse engineering, but then to develop an automatic decompressor, I use just the emulation portion to write a decompressor that would remove Shiva protection at the command line instead of having to work within IDA Pro. The console that controls the emulator looks like this. You'll see it in the demos, and it in some ways looks like a debugging control panel. Okay, we have windows to display register values. You get a default zeros through all the registers when you start the emulator, and you can change those to anything you wish. You have a button labeled step, which will execute one instruction. Okay, by going to the location indicated by the instruction pointer here. Okay, it essentially makes a database query into IDA to fetch the piece of data, okay, which of course is an instruction at this location, passes that information to the emulator portion, which will fetch any additional data from IDA, carries out the action indicated by that particular instruction, and updates the registers accordingly. Okay? Down here, you have a memory display window. At the moment, this only shows the stack. If the instruction manipulates the stack, you'll see data placed onto the stack in this window, and it will grow, and you'll get a scrolling window. And so you can see how data moves onto the stack or off the stack, and you can actually push your own data onto the stack if you need to, for an example, in setting up a function call. We can skip instructions. You may need to skip an instruction, for example, if that instruction is a system call, because IDA, or in a binary, we don't see the source code to a system call. Okay, if you're looking at a Linux binary, which might do an int 80 to trap to the system, okay, that's a swap to kernel space. We don't have that source code loaded in the disassembly, so you don't want to do that int 80. Okay, so you might need to skip an instruction or two or three. Or if you want to skip a lot of instructions, you can just reposition the cursor and jump to a new cursor location, which will reset EIP here to whatever location you've put the cursor in IDA. If you would like to run through many instructions, you can reposition the cursor and just click Run to Cursor, and the emulator will start from the current EIP and execute instructions in an emulated fashion until EIP reaches the cursor. Okay, you'll see, and all interactions with the stack will take place, and so on. We can also, of course, this has started out as a very simple emulator. I've added in more features as I did not try to build a full-featured x86 emulator. What I built initially was enough of an emulation to handle the instructions encountered in various obfuscator tools that I encountered. So I started with Shiva. And only those instructions that were executed by Shiva, those were the only instructions I needed to emulate. Okay, so there's no floating point simulation. There's no MMX simulation in this emulator at the moment. Eventually, I needed to work with segment registers. So if you click here, you can look at the segment registers and change the segment register values if you need to. This comes into play when dealing with Windows and structured exception handling, which relies on the FS register and to set up exception handlers. So using the emulator, once you have your binary loaded in IDA, the current configuration just brings the emulator control panel up with Alt and F8. The instruction pointer is initialized to wherever your cursor location is, and that happens only the first time you bring the emulator up, and then you can hide the emulator and bring it back up without changing EIP again. From there on, you have to use the step and the cursor the EIP control buttons. Simply use the step button to cause execution to work through the program that you're looking at. And every time you step, a nice feature that's built in here is the emulator recognizes the start of every instruction because it knows the value of EIP. So it doesn't matter if you are jumping into the middle of an instruction or not. The emulator knows that an instruction starts at the instruction pointer location, and it instructs IDA to reorganize its disassembly to reflect the proper starting points for various instructions. So if you jump into the middle of an instruction, the emulator will recognize that and instruct the disassembly to reorganize itself properly. So the disassembly becomes more readable, and obfuscation techniques that take advantage of jumping into the middle of instructions are defeated very easily. As I mentioned, we can run to cursor. I do not have any kind of breakpoints implemented yet. Okay, although it is not a difficult thing to do, I just haven't done it. But it would be nice to set breakpoints and run to various breakpoints, perhaps, more like a traditional debugger. The plugin, when it initializes itself, it sets up its own area of memory for stack space. It also supplies its own area of memory for heap space and does an emulated dynamic memory allocation algorithm so that if you want your program to be able to make calls to functions like malloc and free, then you can instruct it to do so, and it will allocate memory off of a heap. And, initially, I didn't have any obfuscation tools that required a heap, but it turned out that ASPAC does a lot of dynamic memory usage, and I had to build a heap into the emulator. Some limitations of using the emulator are it's very slow. You would never want to run a program like this and expect it to run in anything like real time, because each instruction is a number of database interactions with IDA. Okay, we interact with the database. We do a lot of error checking, a lot of memory checking. Is it a stack access? Is it a heap access? Is it program space access? Because we have to figure out where does every memory reference go. Do I need to ask IDA for a byte from its database, or do I go to the stack or the heap that I'm emulating? We can't follow calls into dynamically linked functions. If a program is dynamically linked, then we do not see the compiled assembly language instructions for those dynamically linked functions. So anytime you reach a call to a dynamically linked function, you have to fake it. Okay, this is a place where you might skip that instruction, but if you know what the results are supposed to be, you might be able to force the results by manipulating the EAX register to reflect the fact that the function was called. Okay, sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's difficult. Okay, and I will talk about some of the ways that I've been able to overcome the problems with dynamic linking during the demos. We also can't follow system calls when we have statically linked binaries, as I mentioned earlier. If we come down to an int 80 call in a Linux binary, we can't follow it. Okay, so we may have to do some reverse engineering, ask ourselves what system call is being invoked, and then manipulate EAX to reflect the fact that the system call was successful or not, however we see fit. The memory that the emulator uses, sets up its own stack, its own heap, but it's got to fetch all instructions and their associated operands from the IDA database. So every memory reference gets checked. Because we check every memory reference, if we wanted to, we could build in features such as those available in Valgrind, which is a nice memory profiling tool that can look for memory leaks. It can look for heap overflows and things of this nature. And we could flag those and perhaps write them out to a message window. This isn't a tool for finding vulnerabilities necessarily, but because you can look at the stack, you can see problems that arise in the stack. And because we do check every memory reference, we could see whether we are reading or writing to heap space that really wasn't allocated to our program. Okay, the heap simulation here does not follow any particular memory allocation strategy, and it's a simple linked list allocator. Specifically, if you're looking for heap-type overflows or vulnerabilities, you won't be able to simulate them because there's no control information stored in the simulated heap. Okay, all that linked list information is stored out of band with the heap space that's been allocated. Okay, usually, that's not a problem when we're trying to reverse engineer these binaries. Memory layout can be manipulated. Usually, you get a suggested memory layout, or you can just take the default memory layout, loosely based on the nature of the binary that you happen to be reverse engineering. If it recognizes it as a Linux ELF binary, it will fill in some values that are reflective of the Linux architecture. If it recognizes a Windows PE, it will throw in some values that more resemble a Windows runtime environment. The stack, again, is used by any operation that manipulates the stack, ESP, moving data to any data referenced by ESP, and all of those operations are reflected in the emulated stack and in the stack display window. You'll see all of those changes take place. It also lets you, the emulator allows you to push data onto the stack outside of program control. So you might want to emulate, for example, only one function if you're reverse engineering a binary, and you know that that function takes three parameters on the stack. You don't need to run the entire program to find out where that function is called. Instead, you could put your own data onto the stack and just jump the cursor of the emulator to the start point of that function and begin execution from there. Might look like this. The push data button brings up a dialog box, as you see over here. And you can fill in the data that you want to appear on the stack. When you're doing this, it's basically uses the C calling conventions. So this would be first parameter to a function, second parameter to a function, third parameter to a function, and so on. And when you click OK, these things get pushed onto the stack in reverse order. Highest memory address to lowest memory address. Okay, this is pushed first, the B's are pushed second, the A's are pushed third as we move towards lower memory addresses. Okay, I'll make use of this in at least one of the demonstrations. The emulated heap, again, simple linked list memory allocator, no in-band control information, so there are, you cannot mimic heap overflows. There's no reason that you couldn't replace the emulated memory allocator with a simulation of a real-world allocator like Doug Lee's or something like this. But again, we're not looking really for heap overflow problems. But it can detect access outside of allocated memory blocks if that's important to you. Okay. One of the newer features of the emulator, if you've seen this talk before, is what I'll call function hooking. Okay, or function emulation. There are two ways to do this. I've built in emulations for malloc and free and realloc and calloc and a couple of other of their Windows equivalents. And if you recognize that that function is about to be called in a program, you can either invoke it manually and get a result. For instance, if you wanted to allocate 100 bytes on the from the heap, you could push the number 100 onto the stack, okay, invoke the emulated malloc function, which will return to you an address in EAX that you can later, or you can continue to use throughout the rest of your program. You've been allocated that memory. Okay, alternatively, at any function call, like to malloc, we can ask it to always invoke automatically the simulated malloc call for us. So we actually tie it in. We essentially get a dynamic library function linked to our program. I don't have a lot of these implemented. I've only, again, implemented ones that were useful in looking at obfuscated programs. I'll show some examples of these. Again, the automatic hooked version lets you repeatedly go through a program, and when you see a call to malloc, you can just step over it and you'll get an address of some newly allocated memory in EAX. Manual function hooking has some menu options. Essentially, what you would do is, you can see over there on the right side that you might wish to manually execute malloc or calloc or realloc or free. If you wish to do this, it's up to you to put the required parameters on the stack. Once the required parameters are on the stack, you simply select the desired menu option. If you push the number 100, select malloc here, you'll get back a result in EAX, which is a pointer to 100 bytes of storage that you can use throughout the rest of your program. Automatic function hooking is a little bit different. What happens here is, here's an example of a disassembled function, which we see makes a call to the malloc function. Ideally, I'd like to just step through each assembly language instruction, and when I get to the function call here, I'd like to be able to step through that as well. So what we tell the emulator is, at this location, 8048391 here, we ask to hook a function. We're presented with a list of choices. These are the available functions for hooking. We see that malloc is in fact available, and we can tie this location to a malloc simulation so that every time we step through this location, the emulated version of malloc will be called for us automatically, returning a value, an address in this case, because malloc works this way, an address in EAX of some newly allocated dynamic memory, which will be valid when stored using this move instruction. Okay? Hopefully this all becomes clear when we do some demonstrations. The functions that are currently available for hooking in Windows include virtual alloc and virtual free, which are the Windows analogies to malloc and free from the standard C library. Get proc address turns out to be a very important function for obfuscators because they have to do a lot of their own dynamic linking. They've got to find the addresses of these functions to rebuild import tables that were obfuscated by whatever program is protecting the binary. Get module handle, I threw in there for good measure, and load library as well. We don't ever really load any libraries. All we really do is print a message to the message window that indicates what libraries the program is attempting to load. That might be useful information in the future if you want to know, you know, why is it loading up the Windows networking library. Okay, this can sort of reveal some of the intended functions of the program. From the C standard library, we only have these four memory allocation functions implemented at the moment. Another feature that I added in was the ability to deal with program exceptions when running Windows programs, because the TLOC protector actually generates exceptional conditions like divide by zero or program breakpoint. And you are expected to be able to handle that exception, and it may actually alter data in the program during the handling of the exception. So when you are reverse engineering these things, you've got to first recognize that an exception has taken place, and second, transfer control to the exception handler that has been set up by the protected program. Okay? Transferring that control involves generating quite a bit of data structure information, putting that information on the stack, and then transferring control to a registered exception handler. Okay? I'll go over how we set up the FS register to be able to do this again during the demonstrations. And the current exceptions that the emulator will handle are divide by zero, int 3, which is like a debugging breakpoint, single stepping if the program turns on the trace flag to single step, and any use of the debug registers. The x86 architecture, I don't know where they came along, maybe the Pentium or the 486 introduced the notion of debug registers, which is hardware-assisted breakpoints. So TLOC makes use of these debug registers to insert breakpoints, and we have to respond to those as well. This is, again, just reiterates what I just said, that the emulated program is going to set up an exception handler. the emulator must recognize an exception, and when it does, it needs to set up the proper data structures so that the stack structure looks correct when transfer when control is transferred to the exception handler. Okay. Any questions before we move into demonstrations? Okay. All right. Some demonstrations then, and this will make clear, hopefully, what the emulator is doing. The first protector that I'll talk about is UPX. It's perhaps the most common, but it's also the simplest. All UPX does is compress a program, then attach to it a decompression routine, so that when it arrives or when it is run on a victim, the decompression routine uncompresses the compressed program back to its original form and then transfers control back to the original program. And then the decompression routine is never used again while the program is running. Okay. One of the nice things about UPX is it wasn't written with malicious intent. So the author actually built in the ability to remove UPX protection at the command line. So you can ask UPX to reverse itself at the command line. But there are a number of tools that exist that modify bytes in the UPX headers, in the binary headers, so that UPX will not reverse itself. And when that happens, you either need to edit the headers yourself, which means you need to understand the structure of the UPX headers so that you can fix them and ask, then UPX will recognize it and reverse it, or you can just run it. And it's very simple. This is perhaps the most straightforward to look at. It's just a simple set of loops that unpacks the program and transfers control, as I said. Up until about last week, the emulator did nothing to rebuild the import table because it involves some interaction with getproc address. Getproc address is called repeatedly to retrieve the function address for all of the functions that the protected binary needs to call. You need to, in effect, do your own dynamic linking. Okay, there are now some features built into the emulator that allow it to help you rebuild the import table automatically during the emulation process. And I'll go through how to set those up. Let me see. Okay. So, I need to start a demonstration. I'm going to open a protected program. This was protected using UPX. This program is a Trojan backdoor called Slackbot. It's an IRC backdoor program. And one of the ways we'll try to measure whether we're successful is first we hope that interesting strings will appear. So if you've ever done any reverse engineering or learned any reverse engineering, sort of the least skilled way to do reverse engineering is to run a tool called strings. Strings looks at a binary and extracts and prints out the ASCII strings that are found in that binary. And by looking at these strings, people hope that they can discover what the program does. Of course, you can never do that just by looking at string data. But you know, if it says, you know, I am now connecting to the Trojan server, you know, you might get worried. Okay, so IDA, if you've never seen it before, I'll go briefly through the different windows. Okay, first, over here, the main window is the disassembly window. Okay, so these are all x86 instructions as disassembled by IDA Pro. And it brought us to the entry point of the program. Okay, this is the first instruction that will ever execute in this program. Once the operating system loads the program, okay, that's what happens. You transfer control to the entry point. Okay? And this is all that IDA knows. IDA now disassembles from the entry point, and we can see this function. But if we were to scroll up, okay, all we see is data. IDA did not recognize any instructions in here. And one of the reasons it didn't recognize any instructions is because none of these instructions call or jump into those areas of the program. That's how IDA determines, in large part, what is code and what is data. It does flow analysis, and because it doesn't see any jumps or any calls, it doesn't think that any of that is code. And in fact, it is not yet code. It is compressed data. Over here on the left edge, IDA shows us some nice flow information. Okay, here you see a jump instruction, jump below or jump if it is less than, back to the top. So whenever you see arrows going like this and flow going downward, this represents a simple loop in this program. And if we were to continue farther and farther down, we would see another loop, yet another loop. Okay, and that's how it goes, ultimately, until we get to the bottom here, where IDA makes a huge jump to location 4011CD. Okay, and I can, if we double click on any location in IDA, it jumps us there. Okay, so IDA should have been smart enough to recognize that this is an instruction. It tells us that this code is being referenced from function start. Okay, unfortunately, there's nothing there. Okay, and so because there's nothing there, okay, it's essentially a block of data full of zeros. Because there's nothing there, IDA can't disassemble it. And so that's why we have this very confusing looking disassembly up at that instruction. Now, if we could emulate the decompression, all of these database locations should get filled with instructions, and then we can ask IDA to take a new look at it and reformat all of this data as instructions, and we'll see how that comes to be. So we'll go back to the bottom, actually, back to the beginning of the start function. Over here, we have what's called the names window. You'll see names that IDA Pro knows about at this point. And you can see by the size of the scroll bar, there are not too many. Okay? F means it's a function. I means it's an imported function. So that's a function that's dynamically linked into this executable. And we can go down there and see that this is the small import table that this program has when we start. It only imports a few functions, load library, get proc address, exit process, and just a couple other functions, not too many. Okay, not, certainly not enough to do a lot of damage, and I don't see, well, there is one there, internet open, okay, but not a whole lot of functions that would reveal what the program does. Okay. Again, back in the names window over here, these A's represent ASCII strings. Okay, so if we were to go look at that data by double-clicking, you can see that IDA has organized this data here. It recognizes this as a data segment. This data has been organized as zero-terminated ASCII strings. Okay, and we could get the sense that this program is going to interact with the DLLs that you see here. Okay? WSOC 32, WinINET sort of indicates that it might want to do some networking somewhere in the future. Okay? So we have these little bits and pieces of information, but not a whole lot. Finally, over here, which I've made larger, is the strings window. IDA runs essentially the strings command. that you might run at the command line and displays the output here in a strings window. And you could read this, and it even tells us that this was packed with UPX. So, you know, that's a nice place to start if you're reverse engineering this stuff. And again, the scramblers will take that stuff out so that you can't easily see that it's UPX protected. But if we scroll down through the strings window, we'll see little bits and pieces of strings, but nothing significant. Right? And we can get down at the end and we see the DLLs and the function names from the tail end of the program, okay, from the small import table that actually does exist. So we'll start from there. Okay? And what we hope is that as we run through these decompression loops, that instructions will be, or you know, empty database locations will be replaced with instructions, and that if the program contains more strings, as we decrypt the data, we should be able to observe those strings as well. That's always, when you're doing this, that's kind of a good way to gauge whether you're making some progress, is that most programs use strings somewhere, so that if you have fully decompressed it, you should see strings appearing over here. Okay, so let's get started. Again, bring up the control panel, Alt F8. Okay, so now I have the emulator control panel over here, and I can step through instructions and so on. Okay, I'll go through a couple slow ones. You can watch the registers change if you wish. You can watch the stack change. For example, push A pushes all of the registers onto the stack. Okay, so, of course, all of these have zeros in them. Their EIP is non-zero. But you'll see all of these things. You'll see the stack grow down here. Okay? So we've done some stack manipulation, and down here are all the values that have been placed on to the stack. And we can keep walking through it. Step, step, step. Okay? Not very exciting. Some of the registers are changing. Okay? We might want to, you know, the first time you go through something, you might want to take it slow. But if I do that, you'll be even more bored than you are. So what we can do is work our way down towards the bottom. Now, it is always dangerous if you arrive somewhere and it's going to call something. You don't want it to jump to a function that may not exist, especially if that function, you know, is dynamically linked. So a word of caution as you step through things, or if, as I'm getting ready to do, you run to cursor, you want to make sure that any call statements that you encounter are actually calls to known functions. Okay, I'm going to work my way down because I know the structure of this binary to the point at which it's going to start rebuilding its import table. Okay, which happens sort of down here with the first call. Actually, there's something else I need to set up, but I'll hold off on that. For now, I'm just going to head, stick the cursor here, which is after the last of all of the loops. Make sure that I'm not making a mistake. Call and call. So here, after the end of all of the loops, and I'm just going to go ahead and run to cursor. Okay, we had an hourglass for a little while. It was doing its thing. We got our cursor back, which is always a good sign. If it stays an hourglass, then you've, you know, not reached the cursor. That's part of the problem is when you say run to cursor, you better get to the cursor. Okay? Or otherwise, it may lock up on you. But there we are. We've run to the cursor. And again, I said if we're successful, we might hope that we have strings. So in IDA, it doesn't automatically redo its strings window. I'm going to ask it to rescan all of the strings in the program. And now we have a different result. And as we work our way down, we can start to see that there are more interesting strings, sending some packets of some bytes to some, or with some delay, error executing file, file executed, and so on. We can even see its version string. It's a Slackbot version 1.0. Okay, and so down we go. And as you come down here, you can see things like bang at visit, bang at nick, bang at quit, and you might start to get the sense that some of what this program does involves IRC. Okay, and in fact, you know, it is an IRC Trojan. If you were to continue Priv message, nick, ping, and so on, if you wanted to continue to discover the functions of the program, you could. More interesting things here. If you've looked at any malware, do any antivirus work, you should recognize that registry key. This is a registry key that is commonly used by malicious software to make sure that it starts up every time the system is booted. Software, HK local machine, software, Microsoft, Windows, current version, run. Okay. So we see that it probably does some registry interaction and is maybe not a good program to have running on our machine. Here we have a list of functions. Okay, these turn out to be all the functions that this program is going to want to call. This is the list of ASCII strings that is going to get used when the program does its own dynamic linking. It needs to make a call to getproc address to look up the runtime address of every one of these functions. Okay, so now we have a list of all the functions that this program is going to call, and so on. So the decompression worked. Okay, now what happens? First, you have to, and we can basically stop looking at the strings window for now. At this point, it takes a little bit more reverse engineering sort of to understand what's going on. Before we go any further, I mentioned that calls are a bad thing. All right? And it's going to work down here and call whatever is at ESI plus 80, what is that? 808C hex. Okay? And if we really are interested, we could sort of walk our way down to that function. Notice the cursor changes to reflect EIP address. So each time I step, we can see that we're getting closer and closer, and hopefully I won't be dumb enough to execute the call. So at this point, we wonder, where are we going? I don't know what this function is, but I do know what ESI is. It's right over here. I hope. Let's see. Right there. Okay, 401000. Okay, and I can do some math. Okay, and add that. So 40908C. What is it? 40908C. And again, we have to be intelligent about how we do the emulation. But if we go there, 40908C, jump to that location, and we see that that call equates to a call to load library. Okay, so I definitely don't want to step into that function. I don't have load library sort or assembly language to step into. So this is one of the problem areas. And ultimately, we'll see that beyond 0HC, here at 090, we have a call to getproc address. Okay, and if I was to go back, you'll see that right down here, at this line, we're going to add an offset that ends in 090. So ultimately, this call statement right here is going to call getproc address. Well, the way load library brings a DLL off the disk into memory, okay, we don't care about that. We don't need to do that. But getproc address finds the runtime address of a named function in a given library. So we're interested in that. We need to know what functions are we getting the address of in order to rebuild the import table. And secondly, that address being returned in EAX, we need to know where does that get stored, because that becomes an import table entry. Okay, so things that we're interested in are, here's a call to load library. This will become a call to getproc address. And ultimately, we're interested in what happens to EAX. And if we look down the code, we see that here, EAX is stored into the location pointed to by EBX. Okay, my hand's a little shaky. I'm sorry. Okay, so we become very interested in this particular statement here as well. Okay, so now I'm going to do some of this function hooking that I mentioned earlier. Okay, because what I would like to do is these occur inside of loops. What I'd like to do is set the cursor down here and be able to run to cursor, stepping or automatically running through all of these calls. Okay? So back to load library. I'm going to do some sort of hand-waving magic here. But what we want to do is hook load library and hook get proc address. Okay, which means that whenever I call, make a call to this location, the emulator, once you hook something, the emulator is looking for calls to a particular location. Okay, so as soon as you set up a hook, the emulator starts scanning every address that's used in a call instruction. Okay, so we're just going to add these addresses into the list of addresses scanned or looked for during call function. So I need to sort of jump out of here briefly to steal some IDC script. Because what I really want to do is I'm going to make a change inside the database, because the call to this function does a lookup. Right? It's an indirect call. Okay, when you call this location, you're not jumping to an instruction that's here. You're looking in this location for an address, and then you jump to that address. Right? So that's the address I need to control to set up a hook. Okay, so again, you're going to have to take it on faith here and email me offline for more details on how to set this up. But I'm essentially setting up my own couple of imports. I'm going to change the bytes in the database. Right now, they're just zeros. I'm just going to replace them with the actual address here. You, again, talk to me after the talk if you want to understand exactly how this works. Okay, and now what I need to do is hook the functions. Okay, so I'm going to hook a function. Notice that the cursor location appears in the window down here. This is the location for load library. So I'll choose load library off of my list. And what I'm doing is matching that location to load library. Whenever a call instruction is executed to that location, the emulated version of load library is going to be called. All right? And I say, okay. Move the cursor to get proc address. Hook this function. Again, this matches ending in 90. This is get proc address. Okay. And we say, okay. Okay. So now I've set up automatic function hooking. And now we're ready to automatically step through these function calls. So remember, this is a call to load library. Now, I don't need to load a library, but if I step through here, watch the message window down here at the bottom. Okay, the emulation for load library, I don't know if that shows up better. Is that better? Black on white? The emulation for load library takes a string. The name of the file of the DLL you would like to load. So all the emulation for load library does is tell you that, hey, load library was called, and this is the DLL that was requested. That's all we need to do. We don't need to bring that library in off of disk. We're not going to load it into IDA and analyze that library. Okay. It just lets us know that it was called. All right? Now, I'll step slowly through one. We're working our way down. Okay. We can see we've arrived at what should be a call to get proc address. So we step through that. And again, in the bottom, okay, get proc address indicates that it was called. It tells me what function was being looked up. In this case, the function named exit process was being looked up. And then over here to the right, get proc address, the emulated version of get proc address, maintains sort of internal unique ID numbers that it's going to issue to every function that gets looked up. Okay, in this case, it issues essentially -1, right, all Fs, to this particular function. And I'll show you what the different numbers mean. But every time we call get proc address, it will assign a unique number. If I wanted to hook exit process, okay, I could use this number to hook exit process. Okay, so you don't have to generate unique return values. The emulator will sort it out so that exit process always returns this number, okay, where malloc might return an entirely different number. Okay. Now the next important thing is, where does this value get stored? Okay, it gets stored here. The EAX is going to be moved into the memory location referenced by EBX. Okay, in order to help build the import table, okay, we need to specify that, because it's not too hard, or it's not impossible, but it's too hard to automatically track when EAX is being written somewhere. So I'm just going to indicate that this instruction, 88A1, is what I'll call a get proc address GPA save point. Okay, I'm going to mark that instruction as I say set get proc address save point. All I'm telling the emulator is that whenever you arrive at this instruction, something special is happening. We're storing the address returned by get proc address. The emulator has remembered what the last function that was looked up was. So when you do this, what the emulator will do is name that location, whatever memory location you are writing to, it will name that location based on the name of the process, the name of the function. So we start to rebuild the import table. Okay, I'm going to set that as a get proc address save point. We're going to step through that instruction. Where am I? Okay, one more step. Okay, and we see that a lot of things happened over here. Okay, and it's because IDA does a lot of analysis behind the scenes, and it saw that I named a location exit process, and that exit process, IDA is pretty smart. IDA knows that exit process is a Windows API call, so it does some reanalysis of the program. Well, where did that happen? Look at EBX here. Okay. When you double-click on any register, as I just did, double-click, you bring up a window that lets you change the contents of that register if you ever wanted to edit individual registers. So this is the value in EBX, and I just went there so that I could cut it, Control-C. And if we jump to that location in IDA, okay, we can see that that location is now named exit process. Okay, I wrote the value returned by get proc address into that location. Okay, and we're starting to, which is really irrelevant because, again, we're not really running the program. So the fact that FFFF is an invalid memory address doesn't really matter. Okay, what's important is that we're building an import table. And we see that this location is referenced by sub, whatever that says, this function. Okay, if I was smarter, I would actually name this thing get proc address or the implementation of get proc address, but this is the indirect jump to get proc address. And this is just the way that the compiler builds calls to imported functions. Okay? All right. So we see that that sort of works, and we see that the loop, we got to find out, we want to make sure we get to the right place. Okay, all of these loops at least sort of converge here, and all I'm going to do now is run to cursor now that everything has been set up, and you'll notice down here that we'll have a large number of calls to get proc address. Okay. We could scroll back through the window and look at all the functions that were looked up. Okay. And, you know, see what functions have been imported. Okay. Or we could try to, you know, we could just jump up into this area. And this is all the area where we rebuilt the import table, essentially. Okay, by naming all of these locations, okay, because I set that get proc address save point, Okay, we name these locations, and again, IDA is smart enough, it knows that these are Windows function calls, and it throws up, you know, the function prototype over there, so you get IDA to do some work for you. Okay, almost done with this particular binary. And we'll go much quicker through the remaining binaries. Remember, we're right down here. We step, pop all the registers off, which is just undoes what we did to begin with, and now we're going to jump to the beginning of the program. Okay? Uh-oh. So this is the beginning of the program, and now you can really start reverse engineering. Because all we've really done to this point is remove the protection. But now, the binary no longer protected, I'll turn that into a function. Okay. Now you can look at this binary as it's actually going to run on a Windows system. And now you can do some analysis of this binary to find out just what does it do. Okay. And we didn't, well, frankly, we didn't need to know that it was protected with UPX. Okay. We just stepped through the program. We didn't care whether it had been fixed so that UPX couldn't undo it. We just step through the program. It just doesn't matter because you let the emulator do the work for you. Okay? It doesn't keep you from having to reverse engineer a program ultimately, but it lets you get there perhaps much quicker, okay? And without having to run that program in a lab environment. Okay? Any questions before I move on to the next example? All right. Yes. So this is where we're calling getproc address. So the question, in case you didn't get a translation, I apologize. The question was, it's not quite clear why getproc address doesn't just return a value into the program, or restate.
Right, I think that
getproc address.
Proc address return value of all x.
Correct.
It seems to me you could have just returned that in the program, which would then go in storage in the table.
It does return it to the program. Remember, we're emulating the program.
Right.
And this is where the program. Yeah, this is where the program called getproc address. And this is where getproc address returns to, right here. So we haven't yet had an opportunity to store it anywhere. We don't. In fact, we don't know. You can't assume that, you know, getproc address can't make any assumptions as to what's going to be done with the return value. You might immediately use it in a call statement without ever storing it.
Okay. The point that I'm missing is, why was it necessary for you to specify
here? Yes. Okay. I marked this statement here. I came down to this location, and I think, hopefully, what you were talking about is when I was there, I went to emulate Windows, and I said set GPA save point. Okay. That is because I do not automatically track in the emulator what happens to the contents of EAX. Okay, at this point here, I only know that getproc address was called because, you know, we were doing some reverse engineering and I paid attention. Okay. At this point, before we execute the OR, we as reverse engineers know that EAX contains, you know, the simulated address of some function. But the emulator doesn't track what happens to EAX. It's important in rebuilding the import table, if we store EAX somewhere, it's very likely that we are storing it there as part of building an import table. But in the emulated version of getproc address, I make no assumptions as to what you or what the calling program intends to do with the return value. So the emulated version of getproc address doesn't store the value anywhere because, first of all, it doesn't know where to store it because it doesn't happen until here, somewhere in the future. The value of EBX may change between here and here. Okay? And second, we don't know that it will ever be stored. We could do a call to EAX at this point to call the function directly. Okay? So what I didn't want to do when I was building the emulator was forever monitor writes involving EAX. That was going to involve a lot of overhead. You know, what does this instruction do? Does this instruction write EAX to memory? And if it does, then I'll label that memory location. I was trying to get out of having to monitor everything that happens to EAX. Because EAX could be transferred to another register, and that register could be transferred to another register. And at some point in the future, we might ultimately store that out into memory somewhere. But I didn't want to have to do complicated data flow. So I manually specify, using that memory that menu operation, this is the point at which we are storing the result of getproc address. And by doing that, what the emulator does is it causes an IDA naming operation to take place in conjunction with the execution of this statement. So more than a move happens here. Okay, we move data to the memory location specified by EBX, but we also cause IDA to rename a location. And that pairing had to, that's what I did with the menu operation. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that makes sense. Just the renaming. Yeah. Function.
Yeah, so for those who've never used IDA, what happens here, this location is now called loc 408889. It's named after the virtual address. And you can rename any location in the database. Okay, that location is now called top of loop. Okay, that's a renaming operation. And you can assign a name to any virtual address in an IDA disassembly. Right, so what I do here is when you say this is where getproc address is being saved, you're asking the emulator to automatically do that naming operation. And the name it uses is whatever the last name passed to getproc address was. Okay? Yeah, I'm sorry for the confusion. Okay. All right. Okay, any other questions about UPX? We'll move on to some others. Let's close out of that. Okay. So I think most of the basic features of the emulator have been covered at this point. So I'm going to go a little faster with the next few demos. The next one I'm going to do is called ASPAC. ASPAC makes use of load library and getproc address. It uses them to retrieve the addresses of virtual alloc and virtual free because it decrypts the program into dynamically allocated memory. It doesn't decrypt it into the text segment of the program like UPX did. So first it has to dynamically allocate memory, then it decrypts the data into that memory, and ultimately it will move it around back into the text segment. So this is why we need a heap. It's also why the getproc address is useful. So the emulator does mimic virtual alloc and virtual free. You'll see that I'm going to hook load library and getproc address also. And we've seen how the hooked functions report to the message window that getproc address returns unique IDs for functions that it looks up. And you also see that I've set the emulator up so that it actually does automatic hooking if the function is also emulated. So virtual alloc and virtual free have emulations. And we'll see that it's automatically going to hook those so that I don't need to. Okay? So, back to IDA. I'm going to open up a program. This is an Agobot or a Galbot, if you've heard of those. Again, another IRC type Trojan. And it's this guy right here. Okay. This one, we don't get quite as much information. It's a more sophisticated protection. And we can see that we push all the registers, and then we do call to location 455-007, okay, plus 3. Okay, and the problem there is that the target of this call doesn't fall on a boundary that IDA considers an instruction boundary. After you look at the operands for this call, the next instruction should start at location 455-007. Which decodes to a jump, a near jump to this location. Okay. Instead, this call skips 3 bytes so that the next instruction starts 3 bytes into the call is 3 bytes into the next instruction. So this is a jump into the middle of an instruction. It's a typical reverse engineering technique or anti-reverse engineering technique. And I'll show you how the emulator deals with that really quick. So we bring the emulator up, and we can just start stepping. I don't think I need to do anything else. So step. We've pushed all. Now here we step to the middle of the instruction. Okay? You see that EIP, the emulator knows exactly where EIP ends up after this call statement. So the emulator knows that EIP at 45500A, that 45500A is the start of the next instruction, not 455007. And the emulator has instructed IDA to stop calling that an instruction, E9, okay, and consider the next instruction to start here. So we see the disassembly get reorganized along the lines of actual code. Okay, and we can continue to step through all of these and discovering more instructions along the way. Hopefully being careful. Okay, now here, same thing. We see the plus 1. Okay, work our way down. Okay, and here is a call to a location that I don't know what it is. Okay, I can do the math. I can find EBP. I can add this offset. So EBP is up here. Okay, and I happen to know, having done this in advance, that we're starting to look at these 3 functions: get proc address, get module handle, and load library. So as I did before, I'm going to hook all of these manually. I have to make the match manually. So I'm going to go get some code that I need. Okay, and now I can finally hook these. And that first one is get proc address. Okay, and the second one is get module handle. It starts at 60. And the third one that starts at 64 is load library. Okay. So we can step through this function call now because it's been hooked. We see that get module handle was called to load kernel32.dll. Continue to step. This is another one of those functions. We can see that get proc address was called to get the function virtual alloc, okay, the memory allocator. Notice that this time it returns the number 1 rather than all Fs. So what I do here is, if there's an emulation, I return a positive number. Okay, so get proc address knows that the emulator contains an emulation for virtual alloc. So it returns a positive number. And automatically ties this location, if we need to virtual alloc. Okay? Now, what do we do with that? Okay, here we're going to see that EAX is going to be stored. So I need to call that a GPA save point, as last time. We step through that, okay, and now I have a function virtual alloc defined up here. Okay, we continue to step. We see that virtual free gets called. I have an emulation for that. We have the number 2. Okay, that's going to be stored here. I need to specify that as the new GPA save point. Okay. And now I can step through that. And now we can continue stepping. Now that virtual alloc and virtual free have been hooked, you can actually see it in action. At this point, this is actually a call to virtual alloc. Okay, you can see that we're requesting 1800 bytes, 1800 hex. Okay, and what's going to happen is you'll actually get an address returned over here. A0000 is a pointer to 1800 bytes of memory. Continue to step. We'll call the same function again. Okay. Where am I? A0001804, that's sort of the next available chunk of memory. We just called virtual alloc again, and on it goes. Now, we need to step through here. I'm not going to call this function because it takes a long time, but this doesn't appear to be a dynamically linked function. It appears to be a function that is recognized already by IDA Pro. Okay, so I'm just going to let it run through it. In fact, now I'm going to skip quite a ways down, if I can remember where to skip to. I'm actually going to run it, just let it run on its own, because you don't want to see all of this. Let it run to cursor. Cross my fingers that the hourglass goes away eventually. And if not, I'll take questions. Okay. So remember we had getProcAddress hooked already. We've basically gone through the entire disassembly or the entire decompression. And usually at the end of one of these things, again, we've got to rebuild the import table. So we see a lot of calls to getProcAddress. Okay, and getModuleHandle, looking for handles and addresses of functions and so on. And this is where the import table is being rebuilt. You might ask me, what on earth is going on here, where there's no function name? Okay, and that's because the program is looking up a function by ordinal number. If you understand how libraries are organized, you can either ask for a function by name or ask for it by ordinal number in Windows. And, well, in that case, we don't have a name, so we can't assign one. Okay, but, you know, that's basically, at this point, we can continue to step. And ultimately, what's going to happen is we return to somewhere. Okay, this isn't set up, you know, as a function yet, but we can turn it into one. And this turns out to be the entry point for this particular program. Okay, and we can go back to our strings window and reorganize that to see all of the strings that have been uncovered in this program. Okay, and so we see, again, all kinds of strings, function names. These are the functions that were looked up. Various messages, IRC server, IRC raw, IRC quit, IRC part. Okay, so again, you know, we quickly get the feel that this is an IRC type program. But we have to continue to reverse engineer this program. But we've gotten past the obfuscation without having to run the program. And in a safe environment, you know, inside of IDA Pro. So I'm running out of time, unfortunately. The demos took a little longer than I hoped. So I would like to ask if there are any questions before we break up. And I think, what's next? The keynote or? Yeah. So, okay, there's a coffee break and then there's a keynote. I don't want to make everybody late for that. So I thank you for your attendance. I'll take any questions and I'll be happy to talk to anybody during the breaks anytime today or tomorrow. So any questions real quick? Yes. We need a microphone to pass around so that the questions can be translated.
Concerning the demonstration that you demonstrated, there's a lot of human logic involved in researching and bypassing the defense mechanism of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think are the chances of making the analysis automatically by sensing our software, for example,
mm-hmm.
and emulating the program in order to decode the code and then look for pattern matching, and in that way enhancing the chance of finding viruses and trojans who try to hide themselves? I mean, what are the chances that a couple of months or years from now we'll be able to run this exercise of that?
Okay. So again, the question is, what are the chances that we basically could automate more of these functions? As you saw, it took many manual steps to interact with and set up hooking and things like this. I think any antivirus software could contain an emulator like this. I think that it's difficult to determine the intent of the malicious program or recognize dynamic linking situations. There are probably some areas where, for example, anytime we look at a binary that only imports three functions or two functions, load library and get proc address, there's probably something, there may be something suspicious about that binary. Why does it only import two functions? In Windows, the likelihood that it only needs those two functions is probably zero. So that kind of binary could become a target for emulation, then the antivirus software might choose to emulate some of the functions of that program. It would have to recognize when getproc address is being called. You might try to develop a signature for what are the functions being looked up during getproc address, because we can never automatically recognize the behavior of any program. But we might develop signatures or suspicions based on the kinds of functions that it links to. Say, you know, this program first is protected, and second, it appears that it's going to link itself with a lot of networking functions. So that's sort of a dangerous combination. Why are they trying to hide the fact that they're going to ultimately link to a bunch of networking functions? So you could embed the emulator in an antivirus solution. You might have some rules for choosing which programs to emulate and which programs not to emulate. The difficult problem there is, how much do you need to emulate before you can make a decision? Yes, it's malicious, or it's suspicious, or it's not suspicious. And that's the most difficult problem, and that I really don't have an answer to. But you could do more intelligent things, such as emulation and these sorts of things, in an antivirus solution, perhaps. I don't know when we'll see it. I don't know if I addressed your question or not. Some of the difficulties, perhaps. Okay. Any other questions, quickly? Over here, with a microphone.
Let's say we decipher the program, can we dump the results into a binary file?
Actually, yes, you can. If I bring the emulator back up, one option we have here is based on where the cursor is or any location you want. If you go to the file menu here, we have a dump option. Okay, and then you can specify a range of addresses, and the emulator will query the database and extract all of the binary bytes in that range from the database, and then you can save it to a file of your choosing. There's a range, and I could say, okay, and now I could write that data into a file. And that feature is actually used in another demo, and I can show you the demo offline if you want of how we get a program back out of the Burn-I protector. You make use of it, exactly that feature. Okay? Any other questions? Okay? I thank you very much for coming. If you have other questions or would like to talk more about this, I'd be happy to talk to you anytime. Reception, coffee break, tomorrow. I'll be around for the rest of today and all day tomorrow. Thank you very much.